Lately, we've been talking about the doctrine of karma, the practice of cleansing karma, what karma is. And I thought it might be helpful to continue on in that vein. Here we are in the fall. We're just about to do Sagaki, which is a, karma is a big issue around Sagaki, around the ceremony. And I think this summer I was doing a Dharma talk in Montana, and I mentioned my area of problems are oriented around greed. And somebody that was listening to the Dharma talk asked me to say a bit more about that, and so I about training greed and training training with issues around greed. And I did then, but then of course, as things go, thought about it afterwards and thought there were some other things that I could talk about regarding training greed as it arises in our minds. And so the roots of this talk, kind of go back to then, and it seemed useful to talk about it at this point. Okay, so just so we know, first of all, in terms of the doctrine of karma, there are teachers teaching presently, I've encountered occasionally and encountered students of Buddhism occasionally, who will say that they really have nothing to do with karma or past lives. And this always seems a little odd to me, and so kind of made me think, why, what is that? Why is that there? And realize that, from a kind of technical point of view, if you can't really read more than a couple of pages of classical Buddhism and not encounter the doctrine of karma, and not encounter the Buddha talking about past lives and referencing his own past lives and the past life karma of people around him and how that influences their training. And right at the heart of classical Buddhism is dependent origination, which is really an explication of how karma works. So from a practical point of view, karma is right at the heart of classical Buddhism. And Zen, of course, Zen, the term Zen means meditation, and Zen is a meditation school of Buddhism. So to me, I don't think you can really, I don't think you really need to separate Zen from Buddhism. But still, there might be something worthwhile looking at in why people don't want to don't spend a lot of time thinking about karma, or why they don't even kind of want to, or why they eschew looking at karma. And I think part of it has to do with, from the perspective of meditation, not getting caught up in ideas and doctrines of what's going on, and just really focus on looking clearly at what is happening right now in our minds. And not getting caught up with ideas and formal descriptions of what's going on in our minds, but just really looking, really training ourselves to look carefully at what's going on in our minds from the point of view of meditation. And when I think about it from that perspective, then I can see why a responsible person might eschew the teaching of karma in their teaching of people and their help and their attempts to help people to find what's true and to find the reality of life. For myself, I find karma to be quite useful, the doctrine of karma to be quite useful, and teachings around karma to be quite useful, because it helps to focus my mind on what's going on in my mind. There seems like a natural part of life that is just cause and effect, and part of that is cause and effect on the physical realm, physical level, but there's also this cause and effect that goes on on a kind of moral or spiritual level. And to understand that and to look into it and to embrace it, I think is quite helpful and quite necessary for finding a deeper peace of mind. And so, and you know, it's, I say that it's a natural part of life because, you know, you even hear about it in colloquial terms, you know, what goes around comes around. What we do has effects. And to really kind of narrow in on that, to really look carefully at cause and effect in our own life, I think is deeply important and helps us to really find liberation from our own minds, our own habitual patterns. And so to really focus on that in terms of training at times can be quite helpful. So that's just sort of a little background there. So karma, of course, is, you know, technically speaking, the term karma is actually the result of an action, vipaka. But it is, the doctrine of karma is really talking about cause and effect on a spiritual or moral level. What we do, think, or say, and how it, how the consequences bear out in our life. And it's a it's classically taught by Zen teachers. I mean, Dogen emphasizes the doctrine of karma in the Shishogi, where he says, you know, if we do not recognize that there will be actions from there will be consequences of our actions in the three periods of time, mistakes will be made, and suffering will be grave. And you know, kind of right there, he's saying right there, we need to really look carefully at our actions and the consequences of our actions. And that's, so it's classically a part of at least Dogen's teaching, and to my mind, all of the teachers of Zen in the past. So, broadly speaking, there are two ways that you can approach what goes on in our minds, what goes on in our lives. And one classic way is to think of karma in three divisions: karma of body, speech, and mind. Karma of body, of course, is the karma of our physical actions in the world, and in a sense that's a kind of coarse karma. What we do has, on a physical level, then has both physical consequences, but it also has this kind of moral dimension. So that's karma of body. And karma of speech, of course, is what we say and how that affects ourselves and how it affects other people. Karma of mind is looking carefully at the patterns of our minds and seeing our habitual mental patterns and beginning to work with those things. Now, from this perspective, broadly speaking, we train ourselves in a kind of enclosing a way by working first on karma of body, putting ourselves physically in the position of better karma, and then we start working on karma of speech, you know, kind of work in what we say and how that happens, and then kind of we work again in moving more inward. We work on karma of mind. There's a general progression of that in training, but from the beginning, because we emphasize meditation, we're actually looking directly at our minds right from the beginning as well, and we're working on all three karmas at once. This is the sort of kaleidoscopic aspect of Zen practice. We are not really very linear in the Zen traditions. We just look at things in terms of many different elements sort of all at once and rely on the process of meditation to bring forth things that we need to look at a particular time. So we establish a regular sitting practice. And in our regular sitting practice, over time, different aspects of our life get emphasized, and that's like this kind of the gem of our life or the sphere of our life kind of rotating in front of us, and we see different aspects of it. And so sometimes we might be working on physical karma, sometimes we might be working on karma of speech, sometimes we might be working on karma of mind. And so we rely on our meditation practice, or just our practice of what seems good at a time, to look at those different facets. But then there's the other kind of way of looking at, another angle of looking at karma is looking at the karma of greed, anger, and delusion. And so, broadly speaking, the greed, anger, and delusion are classically called the poisons, and they're elements of our mind that they're kind of areas of our mind that different types of karma manifest in. And now we're talking about negative karma. We'll talk a little bit about positive karma in a bit. So we can look at karma of greed, karma of anger, karma of delusion. Delusion, the primary delusion is the delusion that there's a permanent self that needs to be held onto and defended. But delusion is really just believing that things are a way that they actually aren't. So there's karma of greed, anger, and delusion. And today, it seemed useful to talk primarily about the karma of greed and what that looks like, how to train that, and how it is what it's converted to. So so before we get into that, I just wanted to say that one way we could talk about training, one way we could talk about the path that the Buddha laid out, or the path of Zen practice, or our endeavor to find spiritual reality, is to talk about what we could call maybe cleansing of karma, or the conversion of karma. Or maybe we could even call it the redirection of karma. Karma, of course, is, as I say, the consequences of our actions. And so, in a sense, what we're talking about is learning how to act differently than we presently do, and refining our ability to act differently than we presently do. And in general, there's a process that goes on in training from our course at early in our training, we are working on coarse behavior, and as we move into the deeper aspects of training, we're refining our ability to, as we let go of coarse negative behavior and act differently than that, we're learning how to focus in on more and more subtle elements of our life and mind, and learning again how to act in a different way than we are presently. River Master Jiu Kennett once said that the cause of suffering is actually a very subtle matter within our minds. And I think it's very useful to bear that in mind, that the root causes of our suffering is a very subtle issue, and it is very useful to bear that in mind as we look at things. And so at the same time she was saying, and so we have to kind of go back through our minds and sift through. We're constantly going and looking at our minds, looking at what's going on, looking how things pan out, and on an increasingly subtle level. Of course, sometimes our suffering is caused by something quite coarse, but what she's talking about is the at the root of things. There are some very subtle ways of thinking that we can begin to adjust, that we begin to see more clearly as we go on in time. And those can have a profound effect even on the coarser things. So greed is, of course, wanting something in a sense that we don't have. Wanting something in a sense that we don't have, and yeah, we could just leave it there. It can be a difficult and subtle thing to deal with, because sometimes what we want that isn't there is, basic to our survival as human beings. Food, shelter, medicine, clothing. These are often referred to as the four requisites in Buddhism. And in a sense, the Buddha taught, well, actually, not even in a sense, the Buddha taught that if those four requisites aren't really present, it's very difficult to progress in the spiritual life. And that's not only for monks, but also for lay people. And so one of the things that the Buddha was often promoting was what you might call economic justice, economic well-being for the society around him. And because he knew that if beings were not didn't have their basic needs met, they would not be able to look more deeply into spiritual matters and progress in that way. And so the kind of greed that we're talking about is that greed, that desire, the desire for things that we don't have, which on the level at which that produces suffering. And so there's a degree of wise discernment going on, in understanding what is greed and what greed that causes suffering and what is greed that is for things that we want or need, what we actually need. In one sense, the karma of greed could also be called the karma of craving. And craving, in this sense, adds a sort of dimension to our desire that isn't necessarily present in just the term desire. So we have craving, which is a compulsion to have things that we actually don't fundamentally need. The desire for food, shelter, clothing, medicine, these things are usually satisfied. When we eat something, we're usually satisfied for a while, and then come back to it when we need to. When we have a place to live, we're usually, it satisfies the basic need that we have, and so we can be content with that. Same with clothing and medicine. But what happens is that we begin to add, and this is what craving is, we begin to add a little delusion into our desire for the things that we need. The delusion that something is missing within us, so that we have some kind of fundamental lack that some external thing will satisfy. And that is where greed becomes a driving force in karma. It becomes a driving force in our own creation of suffering for ourselves, where the desire for what we need has added to it a delusive understanding of what it is that we need, or a delusive sense that we have a lack. Now, I think it's important to understand that this principle, when we go into beginning to work with our greed, because it awakens us, it opens our minds to the principle, to the reality that there are things which we actually need, but then there are also some things that we think we need which we don't actually need. And that's where we want to kind of begin to focus our minds when we're working on our greeds. Now, in terms of meditation practice, there is a way in which we can approach meditation and we could talk about it in terms of the absolute quality of meditation, where for the period that we sit, for instance, we can have this absolute approach to meditation, which kind of says, whatever arises in my mind, I will sit still as it's arising. And no matter what, I will let go of what arises in my mind. And I think of this absolute quality of meditation as quite helpful when approaching greed and dealing with greed as it arises in your mind, because it is sort of based in the willingness to not have anything. The kind of, well, first, there's a nice verse that I have written here on my wooden pen case that I received one time when I went to a conference at the City of 10,000 Buddhas in Eureka, California. And it's composed by, this verse is composed by Venerable Master Hua, who was the founding teacher of that temple, that monastery. He says, everything is a test to see what you will do. If you mistake what is before your eyes, you will have to start anew. I like that verse. It kind of bugs me sometimes, but mostly I like that verse. Because it is, inviting me to look at a common condition that I find myself in, which is that I tend to be fooled by what my mind perceives, what my mind thinks it's perceiving. And it encourages me to be willing to notice that I get fooled, and to be determined to look clearly and see what is arising. And with desire, there, greed, there is a component of that going on, which we really would be wise to look carefully at. Now, the types of things that we tend to want, what we think of as greed a lot of times has to do with material things, you know, greed for money, greed for nice car, nice house, nice things. But there are all other kinds of greed, and it behooves us to look at that, because they tend to, greed for material things tends to take place on that level that we're talking about of karma, of body. But there are other things that we have greed for: nice intellectual ideas, emotional feeling, spiritual experience. All of these things can be the object of greed. And I think if you probably reflect on it, you will be able to kind of come up with a few that I haven't listed, and, you know, specifics for yourself. But the point that I want to make is that we can have greed on all manner of different levels. And even if we are able to keep things together on a physical, kind of material level, we can still be quite desirous of things on these other levels, intellectual, emotional, spiritual levels. And, you know, as I say, for myself, I tend to be a creature of greed, and I think my kind of basic kind of mistake in life is oriented around greed. And And as I look at that, I mean, I live fairly simply at this point, have fairly simple, modest material needs. And working on my, I mean, being a monk, you kind of need to not be too emotionally needy. I'm working on that. But I still see that on a certain level, there is desire for a certain kind of love, for instance, and emotional support. And so I have to kind of recognize that that is working in there and tends to and has the potential to distort my decisions during the day. And so it's just a thing to work on. In general, when we're working on karma, when we're cleansing karma, when we're whatever the karma is, our process is the process of really sitting still in the arising of a thing and trying to see it clearly as I'm talking about. So how this manifests is, say for greed, we're working on a particular greed. Let me think, see if I can think of something. A greed for a desire for a motorcycle, to drive fast and have a motorcycle. I don't just popped into my mind, so I have no idea what that's significant of. But so we want this thing, and we want this motorcycle, and so we go out of our way to get the motorcycle. And in having this motorcycle, we tend to get into trouble with it. We break the speeding laws, we get into accidents, we do whatever with around this motorcycle. And so you decide, okay, well, maybe I need to take my training and apply it to my life with my motorcycle. So first you realize, okay, well, I really wanted this motorcycle, and so I got myself into debt over the motorcycle. And so on a kind of physical level, I'm going to have to work on that. I'm going to have to deal with that debt. So you work on that debt, you kind of straighten that out. You sell your really expensive motorcycle and you get a more modest one so that you don't have to have the debt. Okay, fair enough, but there it is. It's still there. You still really like your motorcycle, but you still keep getting into trouble with it. So, okay, I'm going to add more training to that. I'm going to start observing the speed laws on my motorcycle. And you kind of work on that, and you train yourself to do that. Sometimes you take your motorcycle out someplace where you can drive it as fast as you want, just to kind of let off that steam, but you do it in a kind of legal way. I have no idea whether there's a place where you can actually do this, but just kind of metaphorically speaking. So you continue to work on it there, but still, even though you've kind of controlled yourself, you haven't gotten a ticket for years, you still have your motorcycle, it's still causing you trouble. And you still have this kind of desire to race around and drive quickly. And so you begin to look at that desire for speed, or that desire for, you look cool on your motorcycle. What does that mean? Why does that cause you suffering? And so in terms of practice, what we're doing is then beginning to sit still in those emotional responses to our motorcycle and situations around it. We sit still in the arising of that desire to go fast and to have that feeling of driving fast. What is this thing? We just sit still in it. What is it? And at this point, we don't, we're not, we don't, we've kind of controlled ourselves on a physical level. We're not actually getting speeding tickets, but still that desire arises. What is this thing? We sit still in it, sit still in it, sit still in it. And in a sense, we continue to physically restrain ourselves from doing that thing until we have some insight into what drives that desire, or what drives the desire to look cool, and why do we think we look cool if we have a motorcycle. And eventually the more we understand what drives these things, the more we're able to completely let them go, and the less they bother us as painful mental states. So in other words, again, there's this progression. We restrain ourselves physically, we begin to restrain ourselves with regard to speech and interaction with others, and we begin to restrain ourselves in our minds, and to sit still in our minds. And so this happens with all manner of things regarding greed, but also all manner of things regarding the other poisons as well. We kind of work on our lives in that way, progressing inwardly. Now, so I mentioned that greed for love or emotional support or whatever, and this kind of thing is actually pretty deeply set, or so I think. And so it might be, you know, I'll put a little disclaimer. This is not a disclaimer saying for a bid to get people to like me, what I'm about to say. But I think years ago, I remember walking into, you know, as a novice at Shasta, so it was maybe, 12, 14 years ago, and I'm walking into an evening tea at the abbot's house where there are a number of senior monks are sitting around, and two visiting monks who I knew were senior teachers who made the comment sort of in, I can't remember exactly how it played out, but in tandem in some sense, there's Reverend Leon, he just really wants people to like him. And at the time I was not in a very good mood and thought to myself, well, great, that's really nice. Of course I do. But it's actually kind of a helpful observation in the sense that this is an area of my mind that has a misunderstanding about it. There's a misunderstanding in it. And it causes me to do things and think things which are distorted. And the thing of it is, and the thing I wanted to say is that it still arises in my mind, that wanting people to like me. And I still continue to kind of come away from situations in which that part of me has left behind a distortion. I don't know whether at this point, you know, I've been working on it for a while, and I hope I haven't. I'm not as bad as I used to be, but it's still there, and it's still painful to sit in that place. And I imagine that it may well be painful for some time, but my practice is to continue to come back and sit in that place. Sometimes, I'll say something to someone, which needs to be said. I have no idea. And then I'll walk away and think, oh my God, I'm sure they hate me. which often is not the case, and most of the time people don't even notice. But still, that arises in my mind, and it's painful to sit in that place. But again, my practice is to continue not to, in a sense, engage in a conversation with that thing that arises in my mind, oh my God, they hate me, but to just sit still in it, sit still where it arises. And there's a kind of interesting transformation that happens when you're able to do that with these kind of desires or feelings or whatever that arise in your mind, where the thing, in a sense, turns into something that it was not before or simply disappears. There's a kind of classic koan. Koan, of course, is the term for a public problem that is given to a Zen student, particularly in the Rinzai tradition. But also a koan can refer to our own spiritual problem. or our own spiritual question, and in a sense, the question of love and wanting people to like me is right close to my own koan. So there's a classic koan and this is a problem that a teacher has made up to give to a student so that they can kind of get their mind around it and kind of have a breakthrough in terms of their own experience. There's a classic koan called The Goose in the Bottle. And this, you know, it's this story of a person getting a bottle with a small opening and putting a gosling into the bottle and then keeping it there and raising it in that bottle. And eventually the goose kind of grows and gets to the point where it's kind of stuck in the bottle and filling it up and can't get out, but is still alive. And so the problem is, how do you get the goose out without breaking the bottle and killing the goose? And, you know, you kind of read about this and you see all kinds of different interpretations, but I think for my own self, the classic kind of response to this and for my own experience is, well, in fact, the bottle does not exist. And so how this applies to my own mind is that there are often times that arise in my mind where things are kind of unbearably painful or difficult. They're constrained and stuck. They're not moving, they're not going anywhere. It's as if I'm in that bottle. I'm that goose in that bottle. And there is nothing, no matter how I struggle, I can't get out without breaking the bottle or killing the goose. And to understand the response, there is no bottle, it's not an intellectual response. It is the response of what happens when you sit still in that situation in your own mind using meditation. The more you sit still in the uncomfortable arising, whatever it is, whether it's the flames of hatred or the agony of misunderstanding or the compression of, in a sense, greed unfulfilled or desire unfulfilled. The more that you're able to sit still in that and just sit there quietly, letting go, not holding on, not pushing away, this kind of miraculous thing happens where you realize things are different than I think. You recognize this, you see this as a personal experience. This is not true. This kind of feeling of lack, you recognize, oh, that is not true. That is a manufactured part of my experience, something I have manufactured in my own mind. This bottle that is constraining the goose actually does not exist. And you come to know this as the effect of this process of working on karma, restraining ourselves on the physical level, restraining ourselves on this level of speech, restraining ourselves in some sense in our mental life, but also just continuing to work on sitting still in the arising of these feelings and thoughts. And eventually we come to see that there's this transformation that happens in our minds. The constraint does not exist. The bottle does not exist. The goose can just flap around, fly away. This is what liberation is. I can tell you that this happens, and also I see myself being caught by it again and again. Caught by it, in a sense, the same things. I'm not so worried about being caught by it anymore, because I recognize, okay, there's just more to do, there's just farther to go in the path. And I have the experience now of knowing that by sitting still within the difficulty, I see that there's a transformation that happens. Each of us will experience it differently. And that's why, in a sense, the whole kind of business of giving an intellectual explanation for a koan like this is unsatisfactory. Not because it's right or wrong, but because what the purpose of the koan is, the purpose of the problem is to point us to our own heart, to point us to our own experience, and to enable us to clarify what's going on in our own mind and experience. So, again, over time, I know that this process works, and yet I continue to keep getting fooled. Back to Master Hua's verse, everything is a test to see what you will do. If you mistake what is before your eyes, you will have to start anew. It's like, I know over time, and again, I handle this at better or worse, mostly better at this point, but sometimes I'm not so good at handling it, where a problem arises in my mind, or something that I'm working on that's difficult arises in my mind, and for a while I'm confused by it and enslaved by it. I'm back inside my bottle, and so then I'm back inside my bottle, and because of the kind of steady effort of practice, where again I kind of return to my meditation cushion, or I have various things that I do during the day where I'm reminding myself to kind of return to sitting. I realize, oh, here I am. I'm stuck in my bottle again. And I might be struggling trying to get out. I think the other day something was arising in my mind, and I was just, for some reason, I know it's kind of a regular thing. I was just really fighting it, not really wanting to look at what was kind of going on in there. And even though I was kind of trying, okay, I gotta sit with this, I was still fighting it. And it was really until the next morning that I had, after kind of making that effort of just sitting still, I had finally thought, oh, okay, I'm not gonna fight with this anymore, and was able to sit in it. And oftentimes that's because there's some element of it that I have, even though it's a pattern that I recognize, there's some element of it that I haven't seen fully yet. It's painful and I don't want to see. So the process of continuing to sit in it is to just continue to take the thing apart. You understand, oh, this is how the process works, and now I have to keep applying it to my mind. Keep applying it. Sometimes the difficulties arise and I think, oh my God, I've had it, I'm leaving. I'm not doing this anymore. But then, because of the kind of habits that I've built in terms of practice, I just sit with that. Oh, interesting. Isn't that interesting? I hate this. It's completely different than anything else. I hate it. But then I keep sitting in it, and I realize, oh, this is the same thing again. I'll continue to sit there. And so in this way, we just continue to keep coming back. It's like, I've heard of a meditation hall in Japan where the chief priest, the main teacher of the temple, put a washing machine, kind of one of those washing machines where you can, one of the side-loading washing machines with a door and a glass in it so you can see the clothes kind of going around in there. He put that into his meditation hall. So the people that came to sit with him, his monks and other people who came to sit with him, could watch the clothes being washed during meditation. And over time, that's what our practice is like. It's just kind of continually putting the clothes in the wash and turning it on and spinning it around. There's kind of bumps and grinds and stuff, and it's not uncomfortable, not comfortable, but eventually all of the things within us will get washed out by that regular application of just steady practice. So, I think that's what I had to say. Maybe I can add this. On a practical note, with greed, there is for me, my mantra of life is, I can be content with nothing. And to really try to work on that, I can be content with nothing. And I'm not trying, in a sense, to be ascetic. When I became a monk, my mother said this interesting thing. She said, "Oh, that's kind of surprising. I never thought of you as being an ascetic." It's probably a little bit of a libertine, but I'm not really talking about being ascetic in the sense of denying what we need, but I'm just talking about that, about being willing to try to live with less, to try to see what we, you know, I really want such and such, and to think, oh, well, that's interesting. Maybe it's good to have that thing, but maybe it's not. Let's just see what it's like to live without that thing. And in that way, we can approach that thing with that area of training where there are things that we need and there are things that we don't need. How do we know which is which? And to try, if you kind of recognize, oh, greed is an issue for me, I'm not suggesting that you might think to yourself, oh, I'm a greed person, but just if greed is an issue for you, try to live with a little bit less and see what that is like. Live with a little smaller house than you might. The Buddha suggested that that people live, and again, this is back to his ideas of social justice, he said that people should actually live, say, at 10% below what they actually earn. So their standard of living should be 10% lower than what they actually earn, if that makes sense. So you're making more money than you could support a better lifestyle, but you're deliberately, as a point of practice, living at that place of 10% and then saving the extra. And to approach things in that way is to not be denying things for yourself, and it is just to say, oh, I want to see how it is to restrain myself, and to learn how to live with a little bit less, and to really see clearly where that place is. What do I need? What do I not need? And again, I'm not saying people should not have, you know, their computers or their televisions or their nice, you know, sound systems or whatever. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm just saying, see what it's like to live with a little bit less. Make sure I'm not missing anything. Yeah. Okay. So I think that's what I have to say. Are there any questions?
Well, interesting. You talked about greed with respect to our actual physical needs. I've never thought of that as a type of greed, but I see it's true because I think we develop a sense of entitlement that somehow we deserve to be comfortable, a nice house, you know, a reasonable place to live, and enough to eat. The world that we live in, it's possible that those things won't always be there. So it's interesting that that's to even look at that as a type of greed. Not that I hope that none of us would ever lose those things, of course.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, and it reminds me of something. Another way that I tend to try to train my greed, you know, that sense of entitlement is at the very least it can eventually be disappointed, and that can be quite some suffering. So it's worthwhile to just look at that. And there are other problems with entitlement, but the thing that I was reminded of as you're speaking is in the scripture of the Buddha's last teaching, he talks about the practice of contentment and being content. And there's a line in there where he says, the person who has contentment, though he has little, is happy, and the person without contentment, though he has much, is unhappy. Even sleeping on the ground, the person who has contentment, who is practicing contentment with what he has, is at peace. And it's kind of helpful in that to recognize that we can actively practice being content. We can say, okay, this isn't exactly what I want. The way that things are isn't exactly how I would have them in the ideal, but they are enough. I can decide, I can make the decision, this is enough, and practice being content with that. And it's an interesting transformation, because there is a sense in us that we just, there's a kind of continuous grasping after some external thing that is never really satisfied. I get into this deal on the weekends, I'll watch a little TV to relax. And sometimes, if I'm not careful, I can get into this mode where I just, you know, want to watch. I'm a child of the 70s. You know, I grew up, you know, watching TV all the time. And if I'm not careful, I can get into this thing where I just want to continue to watch TV, and I'm looking for just the right kind of program, and I kind of think, oh, whoops, look at that, Reverend Leon, and it's this kind of mind of looking outside of ourselves, which is not just content with being content with nothing. And so it's something that we can apply on all different facets of our life. Anything else? Okay, well, thank you for your patience, and
thank you for your offering.
Please take good care of yourselves.